The Tomb Raider franchise is so recognisable that most non-gamers would have no problem identifying Lara Croft. The character's status as a mascot for the PlayStation, and eventually video games in general, approaches the same fame as Mario. Film adaptations have starred huge Hollywood names like Angelina Jolie, but none hit the exact tone or feeling of its many iterations over the years. Now, we know Lara as a slightly different entity to her earliest appearances, but fans will never forget her trailblazing roots across a trilogy of legendary releases. Tomb Raider 1, 2, and 3 for the PlayStation and PC were part of a shift from predominantly 2D platforming to 3D exploration. It was a time of great creativity for the industry, but a lot of those first 3D games were cartoonish and fast-paced. With its dark, realistic, and mysterious atmosphere, Tomb Raider broke the mold in some exciting ways. Its innovations were always supported by top-tier production quality. There may have been an issue or two with triangular breasts, but the series had greatly detailed visuals for its time. Stacked with rich locations, varied enemies, usable vehicles, and weapons aplenty, the whole package is stitched together by wonderful sound design and music from Nathan McCree. His themes for Tomb Raider's debut trilogy have gained such popularity that fan support through Kickstarter has funded a fully orchestrated rearrangement called the Tomb Raider Suite. The series has taken on a number of different composers since those PlayStation glory days, but players like myself, and others born before the mid-90s, remember Lara Croft and her excursions with Nathan's tunes on top. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in-depth into video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. For this episode, I talked to Nathan McCree about practically every facet of Tomb Raider's sound design and OST. However, the series was far from Nathan's maiden voyage into VGM. His association with the Sega Mega Drive, or Genesis, is extensive, which required him to compose through the acclaimed but limited FM chip. Soon, we'll look deep into how he adapted his process for the PlayStation and Tomb Raider, but I couldn't pass up the chance to discuss his preceding work. Sega's FM chip had some awesome sounds, but its own unique constraints. Nathan was actually employed to code a sequencer for the chip, which is a system for composing with digital instruments. Modern sequencers on powerful, up-to-date systems make your skill and imagination the only limit. So how did Nathan's operate for the 16-bit Mega Drive?
The sequencer looks like a fruit machine. You've got six channels, and each channel is a voice, a single voice. So I've got a total of six voices that I can play simultaneously. And you define the length of your pattern, say 64 beats or quantizes. You hit go, and it rolls round those 64 ticks. You can't kind of play it like a piano. You skip through the barrel with a sort of skip button, and it moves it on to the next quantize slot. And then you've got a cursor which goes across the six barrels, and you can add, sticking a C sharp in that one, sticking a G in that one, sticking an F in that one. Okay, test it, and it runs round, and when the three notes come up, ding, they play a chord. If you've got musical knowledge, you understand how it's going to work. You understand that, you know, every four ticks is a quaver, you know, every eight ticks is a crotchet, you know, so you know how far around the barrel you've got to kind of make the notes hit at a certain frequency and a certain rhythm.
The way I imagine it is like a virtual music box, a cylinder or disc that rotates with its notes as pins or holes around its surface. As the cylinder spins, the notes are played in sequence, which then produces a tune. As elegant and effective as such a sequencer is, especially when applied to the FM chip, it will never be able to recreate a full-size orchestra.
I think that the most complicated aspect of it is because you've only got six notes, you know, if I'm trying to convert an orchestral score, which I did for Asterix and the Power of the Gods, I converted a load of well-known classical pieces. And the difficulty was squashing an orchestra into six notes. You can only have six things playing simultaneously, you know, so you've got to do a lot of sort of playing between the beats kind of thing to get your melody out, you know. I mean, and if a melody hits on a chord, you know, what you do is you find the common note that's already playing in that chord and you play the melody on that channel so you don't miss a note.
All the best composers who had to wrangle quality music from the earliest sound chips never really saw it as restricting. You can hear a lot more about composing for systems like the Commodore 64 in an upcoming special with Rob Hubbard and Ben Dalglish. A few years on from the C64, the Mega Drive's FM chip was definitely more sophisticated, but many things modern producers take for granted were still a lot harder, or simply impossible. People like Nathan McCree, Rob Hubbard, and Ben Dalglish played to the strengths of such systems to get the best results.
Anytime when there's a challenge or a limitation placed on what you've got to work with, yeah, it just adds to the fun, really. It's just like, how can I do this? How am I going to do it? Okay, and you find a way of doing it, you know, musically. So you're using the system for what it's good for, and it can do some really clever things. You know, for instance, it's a stereo machine, so you've got like one barrel which comes down the left ear and one barrel which comes down the right ear. So what you can do is you can kind of play a melody on, say, the left channel, and then you copy that barrel to the next barrel, but then what you do is you shift all the notes, say, two quantizers down, and then you play those quieter. So now what you got? You've got a delay.
Without wanting to patronise any producers listening to this podcast, a delay is a form of echo you can add to instruments, and it's been put into wide use as an effect since tape loop experiments in the 1940s. Some kind of delay can be heard on almost any modern recording. Adding a good delay to an instrument is just three or four clicks away on the programmes of today. But it was never that easy for Nathan on the FM chip.
You can make the machine generate real-time effects, or mock it up so it sounds like a real-time effect. So you can create delays, you can create multi-tap delays, you can get like not just one, but you can get a third delay on another column and a fourth delay on another column, you know, and you move them down each time, so you get it does affect how you write, but that's just a good thing. It's just like a new toy, you know, a new synthesizer or a new effect track or something. When you get it, it's like, great, you know, let's play with it, let's see what it can do. You're trying to do everything you can with it to make the piece of music as interesting as possible, and the limitations just make it good fun.
Every composer I've spoken to who coded their music mentions how much fun it was. Some even lost interest and moved into other areas as the possibilities for digital audio grew. When consoles like the PlayStation came along, a lot of doors opened for sound departments. The change in technology is audible from Tomb Raider's opening notes. So what new features did the PS1 era offer, Nathan?
More tracks, more polyphony, more notes simultaneously. That's virtually unlimited because I can just add another synthesizer, you know, and you can increase the amount of notes you can play simultaneously. So that's virtually unlimited. The number of tracks or the number of different instruments, again, is virtually unlimited with MIDI. Again, it's just down to how much outboard gear you've got. There weren't orchestral sample libraries at that time, so we were limited to using synthesized orchestral sounds. Now, obviously, they were much better than the synthesized orchestral sounds that I was making on the Genesis, for example. Roland's versions are much more superior. Their signal generators on their synths are much more powerful, so you get a much more complex timbre of tones. So you can make much better sounds. You know, the pianos sound better, the violins sound better, the brass sounds better, all that kind of thing. So you're getting closer to a more realistic orchestral sound. It's not the real thing, obviously. And even with sample libraries, even these days, there's something missing from a real orchestra.
Even in 2018, virtual instruments don't completely hit the nail on the head. They can be damn close and indistinguishable to most listeners, but there's always an element of human expression that they just fail to capture. For VGM composers, the ramp up in technology between 16-bit sound chips and the PlayStation was obvious. There were better instruments, the space to use more of them simultaneously, and a wealth of more intuitive effects.
Suddenly it's like, well, we can make a sound that's very, very close to this now. So the time it took us to develop stuff was longer. You know, we had to spend more time setting all this stuff up, setting all the outboard gear up, so it was all working. And also, you know, we can add anything that we want to record. So we can add live instruments. We can add ourselves playing stuff for real, or singing, or all that kind of stuff. So suddenly it really did open up what we could record to basically what we could imagine. We weren't limited anymore to just being able to create sounds which the Genesis chip could generate. Now we can basically generate any sounds we want.
Listening to Tomb Raider's music next to the FM chip, the new capabilities of the PS1 clearly made a big difference. The sustained woodwind note that opens the soundtrack is deeper on its own than the Mega Drive could dream of. When plucked harps and gorgeous string swells join the fray, it steps even further from the coded pens of previous consoles. What was Nathan's process for Tomb Raider after those steps forward? And how did he arrive at the right tone for the series?
Okay, so I'm sat in a studio. I've got a load of kit. I want to make a certain sound. I think it needs more keyboards. So I go to my boss and say, I need a new keyboard. And he said, fuck off, you're not getting one. Okay, so I've only got these three. Well, I've only got these two. So it's like, okay, well, I've got 16 instruments on that one, 16 instruments on this one, 64 notes on that one, 64 notes on this. So I know I've got my limitation now. So it's a bit similar like the Mega Drive. I had six notes, you know, six instruments. Now I've got 128 notes and 32 instruments. Those synthesizers made some orchestral sounds really good and some orchestral sounds were a bit shit. So I naturally, because the brass weren't or aren't very good on the 1080s, I sort of steered away from using brass a little bit. Some brass textures are all right, like the horns, but trombones, stuff like that, it's like, ugh. I tended not to use those just because I thought they didn't sound very good. The strings were really good on the 1080s, and the woodwind stuff was really good. Percussion also not bad. So that kind of steered what instruments I was putting down. Because when I added something that sounded rubbish, it was like, oh, I'm not going to use that. So no trumpets in Tomb Raider.
There have always been issues with synthesizing brass instruments convincingly. The first Tomb Raider trilogy has an impressively organic feel, despite being digital, and the sometimes amusing parps and toots of virtual trumpets would only undermine it. So, the availability of good instrumentation was still a consideration, along with Lara Croft and her environments, but Tomb Raider's sound was also honed by a certain amount of pressure.
You know, I think I only had about 3 weeks on Tomb Raider 1. And it's, you know, you're writing a tune a day. You're going as fast as you can. That also steers you into, you know, how many instruments you're putting down. Because you've only got enough time to perfect 10, 15, 20 instruments. Any more than that, it's like, well, we're over a day. Sorry, lads. Track's got to finish. Out it goes. I guess they're the major factors as to sort of why I ended up writing what I did. I guess the third factor is down to the sort of brief, you know, when I talked to Toby Gard about the kind of music he had in his head. So between the two of us, we decided on, you know, English classical music. We thought that best described Lara Croft. So you got English classical music, a limited amount of time, and a subset of orchestral instruments that sound good.
From those three important factors, technology, time, and the game itself, Nathan had the formula for Tomb Raider's sound. As rushed as he may have been for the series' debut, he hit on something that worked, flowing through the series into both the second and third installments. With settings to convey, a character to symbolise, and his choice of instrumentation ready to go, how did Nathan structure his writing for the tunes themselves?
Most of my compositions start with patterns, usually with something like the harp, some instrument that plays multiple notes. And, you know, I find patterns that I like or that are interesting, and then I sort of layer on top of that to sort of fill them out, give them a bit of warmth from the strings or the horns or something. And when I've got a sort of, I don't know, a 4-bar or an 8-bar section of the orchestra sort of mapped out or playing something that I like, then I spend 2 or 3 hours just playing around with melody. I find an instrument that I think is right for the character, and I just play with it. Play and play and play and play and play, and bit by bit you just perfect the melody. Moving a note a bit later, a bit earlier. No, it says it too late. Oh no, now it says it too early. No, it needs to wait a bit more, you know. Doesn't want to go up too high because it's too much of a jump. Doesn't want to go too low because it sounds too depressive. You know, all this kind of thing. One of the things that I do try and do with my melodies is keep them simple, because although people can remember complicated melodies, most people remember a simple melody easier. So, you know, if you're trying to appeal to a lot of people, keep it simple.
The Tomb Raider theme's main melody uses only 4 notes as a basis. Nonetheless, any gamer familiar with the series is taken directly back to Lara's adventures when hearing them. By writing a simple melody, Nathan uncovered a theme that could repeat and recur while switching its mood to fit the circumstance. All it needed was a fresh set of chords behind it, or some rhythmic tweaks, and the main theme could support a range of emotions.
The other thing that's kind of useful when a melody is simple is that you can harmonise it in lots of different ways really easily. So you can say different emotions, but with the same melody, just by changing the harmony that's underneath it. And that's easier to do when the melody is simple. If the melody is really quick and complicated and has loads of notes, it's like, ugh, that takes more time to harmonise it in different ways because things are happening much quicker. And so you've got to pay attention to the notes changing and thus change your chord much quicker. But with a melody that's slow and simple, you can literally play one chord and let it sing, play a different chord and let it sing, you know, and it will create a different effect.
Music is absolutely key to immersion in video games, and Nathan's themes invite you into Tomb Raider's caves, temples, and ruins masterfully. However, throughout the first release, the soundtrack largely stays quiet outside of scripted events, menus, and cutscenes. During gameplay, sound effects mesh into a lifelike ambience. Other times, quick, descriptive flourishes can act as rewards for positive pickups, while dissonance punishes careless actions. Nathan took on sound design for Tomb Raider, as he has on many titles across his career. The role is, for all intents and purposes, entirely separate from writing music, with its own rules and mindset.
There are lots of different sort of tricks of the trade and things that help you design good sounds as opposed to bad sounds. Things like, you know, all menu sounds should sound like they've come from the same family. There should be sort of some common audio element that sort of joins them all together so they sound like they're all part of the same thing. That's one thing which I've learned, which makes for good sound design and front end for games. I mean, pickups and, you know, rewards and stuff like that. Again, there are sort of melodic ways of describing these. If it's just like a cash pickup, you'll often hear in games, "Bidling," major arpeggio, C E G C, "Bidling." So that's like a major chord makes you feel happy. So obviously, when you pick up something good, you want to describe that with a major chord. If they, say, step on something which causes them to lose some hit points, you want to be describing that with some negative sound. So it wants to be either a minor chord or some discord, you know, some grating sound, some sort of harsh, painful sort of sound. You don't want it to be nice and on the flute. As with everything, when you pick up a medipack. Thank God for that. It's just information sounds. It's just how can I tell the player what it is that they've got with a sound? So again, you're thinking about trying to speak with the sound that you're making for that particular item. And we call them information sounds. The sound itself should tell you what it is that you've got. For instance, if I pick up some ammo, you'll often hear in a game, shh. When people run out of bullets, you'll hear a tick, 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 or just a click, obviously, because you're not firing any weapons. Some put a tick, boom, you know, like this, to sort of tell you that, you know, things aren't working. So the idea is that from the sounds, you know what it is that you're picking up without having to look at something or read something on the screen from the GUI to sort of find out what it is. The sound should be able to tell you, and a good sound designer should be able to do that.
Nathan's sound design for Tomb Raider is astonishing at times, and I still think of the game's iconic secret chime whenever I find some lost socks or keys. Neither of those things are as majestic or interesting as the relics Lara Croft covets, but a 3-second noise from a game I played when I was 7 remains lodged in my consciousness 2 decades on.
So with the secret sound, it's a good thing that she's found it, but it's also a bit mysterious because you didn't know it was there. And, oh my God, I found a secret. You know, what is it? The notes that I used kind of ask a little bit of a question. What is this that I've found?
For Tomb Raider 2, which released a year after the first in 1997, Nathan had his production time increased from 3 weeks to 3 months. He'd been able to work wonders with a short window, but the extra room he had for the sequel shows in its soundtrack. In the game, Lara Croft travels the globe on a quest for an ancient dagger. Her adventures take her through places like China, an abandoned shipwreck, Tibet, and most memorably, Venice.
when it came to Venice, I'd started sort of developing my own sort of music system, which was just a sort of collection of moods which I could use at various places in the game. And that was sort of expanding in Tomb Raider 2. But what was expanding out of that was these sort of location tunes, where something specific happened at a specific place, and we described that with a special piece of music. And Venice was one of those. You know, you go through that quite difficult puzzle to unlock, you know, to fill the lock of water, and you can get in the speedboat and off you go. But when you first find the speedboat, of course, you can't get it out. You have to solve that puzzle to get it out. Well, we're in Venice. Let's play some Venetian music. Let's play some really sort of, you know, Venetian dance music, because that's effectively what it is. It's dance music from the 1500s or 1600s. I listened to a few people from that time, Vivaldi, Bach, you know, those guys that were sort of hanging out in Venice and doing their thing, and I just kind of listened to that and just stylized a piece that used a similar kind of instrumentation and just wrote something a little bit like Vivaldi. And I think it was just an unusual thing, but at the same time, it fitted really well, because there you were, you're in Venice, and that's what everyone expects to hear when they're in Venice.
Nathan's music for Venice is adored by fans, and it was among the most requested tunes for the Tomb Raider suite, which aims to rearrange themes from the trilogy for a real-life orchestra. Venice in particular begs for authentic instrumentation, and what I've heard of its rendition for the suite is just right. There are some important stops left before we reach Nathan's thought on that project, however, and there's someone we can't forget when discussing Tomb Raider 2. Winston, Lara Croft's rickety but loyal butler, left such an impact on players that locking him in the freezer is now a necessary rite of passage. Voiced by none other than Nathan McCree himself, what led to the inclusion of Winston and his geriatric quirks?
Winston was, he sort of came about as a last minute decision, really. I don't think he was in the plan of the original game at all. It was just, you know, we were building stuff, chucking stuff in, and somebody said, oh, wouldn't it be cool if she had a butler that just kind of followed him about? Oh, yeah, let's do that. Okay, so then we all decided to make him. So, you know, somebody will start designing his character, you know, visually. Somebody else will kind of work on his animation and his movements. And then I get to see it. And it's like, okay, so I've got to make him sound. So obviously we've got the shuffle of his feet. He's a bit of an old doddery guy, you know, so he's got this tray of tea that he's taking for Lara everywhere, and of course, you know, because he's shaking from old age, clink, 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 clink. And then, you know, the sort of main comedy factor about him was that he sort of grunts and groans as you bump into him or run away from him, you know, without really saying any words. We didn't really want him to say anything, because that's boring. We just needed him to make a few noises.
As much as I love Red Dwarf, Hollywood did Winston a great disservice by casting Chris Barry to play him on the big screen. Instead of an old git who can barely hold onto his tray, the 2001 film portrays him as a shotgun-toting busybody. Clearly, the only appropriate pick for the role is Nathan McCree.
I mean, it was me that made all the sounds for him. It wasn't a case of hiring somebody in or anything. It was a case of, right, let's make some noises. So it's like, meh, meh. So I recorded a load of grunts and groans for him, and then I grouped them into categories of why he'd make a particular sound. So we've got huff, which is when he's just like, huh. There's surprise, when, you know, you suddenly run around a corner and bump into him, he goes, meh. So then we got the idea of him farting, you see. And we thought, wouldn't it be good if, you know, he was a bit flatulent, and every now and again he'd sort of let rip. We decided that this would be really funny, but we were worried that we wouldn't get it past QA with Sony, as their quality assurance. They have to test everything that we make, and we have to send them a document telling them what we've put in the game so that they can test it, and we have to be very, very clear about that. So I was a bit worried that they weren't going to give us the thumbs up for the farting. I spoke to one of my programmers and asked him if we could bury it in the game somehow, if we could hide it. So we came up with this cunning plan to hide it. And we did. You have to do a certain combination of moves, and if you do, then he'll fart. Of course, they never found it. So it went out in the game publicly.
I've read frighteningly long arguments about whether Winston's gas problems were intentional or not, so that answers that. But the developers never actually knew he could be trapped in Lara's walk-in freezer. Some found Winston creepy, but others found him hilarious. All were so intrigued by him that the cruel freezer trick was soon invented and spread around schoolyards.
You know, he just kept following around Lara, and the fans actually discovered that you could lock him in the freezer. Again, that wasn't our design. It was just something that came out of the design. The room was quite big. You could get two people in there. You could get him to follow you and jump over him, run out and press the button. So that was kind of just a bit of good fortune, really.
Tomb Raider 2 was a critical and commercial success, like the original, and ventured into different musical lands comfortably. Its range of sounds was deeper, bouncing off the game's locations, and more sophisticated thanks to the extra time Nathan had to compose. After its release, Nathan went freelance, but was so integral to Tomb Raider's tone that he was contracted for Tomb Raider 3 regardless. The last title in Lara Croft's classic trilogy, Tomb Raider 3 presented all the gameplay that fans loved with some fresh features and less linear maps. Again, the plot sees Lara whisked away to foreign lands, and we hear their cultures in the score. For Nathan, authenticity is important, so how did he incorporate that accuracy into his themes?
I get information from the designers on the game. Oh yeah, she goes to a jungle, Indian jungle. I'm like, fucking Indian jungle, right, okay. Go through my, you know, my synth sounds and see what world sounds I've got. There's a cymbali, there's a this, there's a that. Yeah, that sounds okay. There's a Zimmer, you know. So I'm just kind of finding stuff that might be useful. Got some tablas. Okay, that might work with a sitar. They're both Indian, you know. Again, you do your research. You go away and you listen to some sitar players, listen to what they do, the kind of chords that they make, the scale, the notes that they use in their scales. And then you start playing with that. And once you start using their scales, their harmony, with your sound, it's like, oh, that sounds Indian.
Nathan took his role seriously, as it could have been so easy to write a lazy pastiche of what we think another culture might sound like. Instead, he not only chose the right instrumentation for any given setting, but applied appropriate scales and chord sequences too. If you want to be meticulous, as all the best are, you also think about what individual instruments might mean depending on context.
I might have to just do a bit more research around it and just look up the instruments a little bit more, look up when they're played. You know, because some instruments are used only when people die, only when people are born. So you got to be careful about what you use and why you're using it. And this is where you need to kind of, you know, research around those subjects a little bit more. You know, we have had things refused from games. You know, we've had to cop material because in England, it's fine. Nobody bats an eyelid. It's a pair of chopsticks in a bowl of rice. They say, you can't have that there. Doesn't work. That means that sends the wrong message. Oh, shit. So we have to cut out the bowl of rice.
An example of this that's always stuck in my head is when Oddworld removed a whole finger from its harem, Abe, and his species. The Mudokon's first four-finger design was seen as so distasteful to a whole class of Japanese society, whose industrial occupations often cause lost fingers, that the resulting redesign stuck for all markets and future games.
You know, it's little things that you're not aware of, and that's what a localization team does. They check the territories that the game is going to, and they check that you're not, you know, insulting anybody or, you know, sending out the wrong message, or it's not some horrible urban myth that you're depicting or something like this. You know, all sorts of things. So it's that. It's just kind of, like I say, just reading around the instruments that you're using and just, you know, trying to make sure you're doing the right thing.
Obviously, no research was needed for the quintessential British humour that peeks into the game, again through our old friend Winston. Lara's Mansion is a tutorial level of sorts across the trilogy, and the only place where you can interact with Winston. No matter where you go, he'll slowly make his way toward you, shuffling, groaning, and clinking his tea on his way. Tomb Raider 3 even graced gaming's gassiest butler with a redesign.
So in Tomb Raider 3, we thought it would be better to sort of give Winston a little bit more of a purpose than just following you around and getting in your way, which was really annoying. Although, of course, when he got in your way, he'd be going, "Meh, yeah." But we thought in Tomb Raider 3, let's give him a bit more of a purpose. So if you drew your guns on him, he'd hold his tray up and he had a target. And you could use him for target practice. And he had a World War II crash helmet on. It was so funny, man. So, you know, Winston was just all about humour. It's just British humour. It's just like, let's just do something hilarious. And that's what Winston was. He was just the comedy factor in the game. I don't know why people took him out. Man, he's like, for me, he's the star of the show.
After Tomb Raider 3, Winston was relegated to total silence and mostly just standing still. Nathan departed the series too, and it started to move away from its traditional roots. Lara Croft has been rebooted and repackaged enough that the version we know today is only recognisable through her accent. This podcast has no interest in arguing the merits or missteps of Tomb Raider as it's evolved, preferring instead to concentrate on the subject at hand, Nathan McCree and his work on its audio. Though not attached to any remake or new game project, his recent Tomb Raider suite is clear evidence of his music's stopping power. His orchestral arrangements feel like a triumphant return, and actually include brand new sections and melodies naturally weaved into famous themes.
I just simply went about it the same way that I did 20 years ago. I think one major consideration I was conscious of was trying not to overcomplicate the new material, because 20 years on, I write stuff in a different way than I did back then. You know, my tastes in music have changed. My tastes in harmonies have changed. So, you know, I was adding stuff and going, no, that's not Tomb Raider. That's not simple enough. That's not beautiful enough for her. You need to kind of, you know, back off a little bit. It's too complicated. So I was sort of writing stuff and then stripping it out again and thinning it back down to sort of make it gel more with the original material. I think it worked. I was quite pleased with with the results in the end. Some of the tunes were took a little bit longer than others. Time to Run was a bit tricky to get right, the new section in that.
Of special note is In the Blood, which Nathan wrote especially for the suite. In it, Nathan brings all of his experience as a musician and producer since Tomb Raider to the table, mixing it in with his founding themes. It received a standing ovation at its live debut, and makes me imagine a brand new game soundtrack from Nathan in the same vein.
In the Blood just kind of rolled out. It was really good fun to write, and you know, really enjoyable, and it was good to kind of go back into that world of Lara Croft and Tomb Raider, and yeah, sort of relive it, I suppose.
Since the developers behind Tomb Raider have largely moved on from the original trilogy, Nathan heavily relied on fan support for the suite. In a glorious proof of the popularity of video game music, backers quickly came together to make it a reality. At the time of releasing this podcast, physical editions of the suite will be on the edge of release. How does it feel to see such an ambitious project grow from the love of fans?
Those 30 days was, you know, nail-biting experience, but a very humbling one to see all the backers get behind us and push us over the limit into our stretch goal sort of area. You know, that was great. It was fantastic to know that, you know, they're out there and the support is there. So, you know, we keep chucking out the updates and just keeping people informed, just being honest about what we're doing. When we get a delay, we get a delay, you know, and we try and not let that happen. But invariably it does. With any creative project, there's what we call project slippage. And that happens because you're creating something new and you're going into territory that you haven't gone before. So, you know, you try and think of everything that you're going to have to do, but invariably there's something that pops up and goes, oh, we actually have to do this before we can do that. How do we do this? So then you've got to start asking people, can you help us with this? Do you know about this? What do we have to do? Oh, you need to do that. Oh, shit, that's going to take us a week. Suddenly you've got a week slippage. The project is moving forward. It's not at risk. It's just taking time.
Pieces from the Tomb Raider suite have been performed in front of audiences to massive acclaim, but community-supported projects are often subject to change.
The music itself didn't change, but the orchestrations did. We had a slightly bigger orchestra for the recording at Abbey Road, so we had to add a few extra brass instruments and woodwind instruments, and we increased the size of the choir from 16 to 40 people. And although the score for the choir didn't change, the fact that we've got a bigger choir meant that the blend between that and the orchestra is now different. Sometimes we had to double up on a melody just to make it a bit stronger because the choir was going to, you know, drown it out and this kind of thing. So they're all considerations which my orchestra takes care of. Again, it's not a field which I am experienced in, so I need, you know, a professional on that to make those alterations, but the musical content is exactly the same as the concept.
What Nathan achieved in his soundtracks for Tomb Raider is incredible. Through his clever use of technology and instruments, strong melodies, and even his knack for good sound effects, Nathan brought the game to life. It all feels like Tomb Raider, like Lara Croft, with unique flair to the tracks that score exotic lands. His music's maturity is precisely why it fits so well with an orchestra and can take on a second life, rearranged and reimagined. Nathan composed serious, sincere themes, exactly as the series needed, in a conscious effort to show the medium's mettle.
You know, one thing that I wanted to try and do with Tomb Raider was add emotional content, which I thought was missing from computer games. You know, most games are all sort of bombastic battle music or, you know, hardcore dance rhythms for driving games. You know, there wasn't any love, there wasn't any sorrow, there wasn't any sadness, there was none of that. And I thought, well, look, gamers watch movies and they love movies. And in movies, there's tons of emotional content. So why weren't they like it in a game? That's really kind of my mindset behind the music from Tomb Raider. I just wanted to kind of add some real emotions that weren't really apparent in the games industry.
Thanks to Nathan for speaking to me for the sound test, but thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to subscribe or follow on whatever platform you might be listening on. There'll be a new episode each week, with next week's welcoming both members of Ridiculon, John Evans and Matthias Bossi, back onto the sound test to delve into the classically inspired OST for The End Is Nigh. Check back here at 5 p.m. UK time on Fridays for all future releases.